opening investigations into protesters in Minneapolis. And the Civil Rights Division says they're not bringing civil rights charges against the agents who killed U.S. citizens in Minneapolis. We have 20 seconds. Your final thoughts.
When you have an agency killing people, executing them, lying about it, and then talking about investigating themselves while operating with impunity, you know exactly what is happening. ICE needs to be abolished. DHS needs to be dismantled. And we need to bring justice for every single person being experiencing the harm, the chaos, and the terrorizing in every community in this country.
Illinois Congress member Delia Ramirez speaking to us from Chicago. We want to thank you so much for being with us. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kbu.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kbu.fm.
Follow KBU on Instagram at KBU Radio. Ear to the Streets.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBU Evening News.
Coming up on the KBU Evening News, Portland City Council wants the ICE facility fined for not following land use policy.
Oregon lawmakers want to talk about the kicker.
And in national news, Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar assaulted at a town hall.
Good evening. This is the KBU Evening News for Wednesday, January 28th, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. The Portland Community Board for Police Accountability is set to have their first meeting in February after being passed by voters in 2020. But the start of their work could actually be in 2028, meaning the old police oversight system must keep working, all while losing staff, volunteers, and funding. KBU's San Bauman reports.
The oversight system is quietly falling apart, and it could be years until the voter-approved Community Board for Police Accountability actually takes the reins. At their meeting on January 7th, leaders of the Citizen Review Committee, or CRC, raised concerns about delays to the new system and a lack of a clear transition plan from the city. Under the current system, the CRC has three main functions. They hear appeals of police misconduct findings, they educate the community on the process of filing complaints against the Portland police, and they fill the voting seat designated for a community member on the Police Review Board. Their work will eventually be replaced by the Community Board for Police Accountability, or CBPA, in a process mandated by voters in 2020. But at the pace things are going, that could still be 2 years away. The work of the CRC is critical to keep Portland in compliance with a 2012 settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. The CRC must meet every quarter under the settlement agreement, and they failed to do so in the last quarter of 2025. Without citizen oversight of police, Portland violates the settlement agreement, opening the city up to action from the Trump administration. It would also leave the public without a process to have complaints against police investigated by an independent agency. Yume Delegado, is the chair of the CRC, which is a volunteer position. At their January meeting, he expressed worry about how the existing system could continue to function and serve the public until the new system takes over.
What is the city's plan, right? We have no money. We're increasingly losing staff. And, you know, a lot of us have been doing this job for now half a decade. Frankly, you know, I start to wonder if I'm actually living up to the oath I swore to uphold the city charter, because we're not delivering on what we gave to the, what we promised the voters we would do.
CRC members are leaving the committee, opening up the possibility that there won't be enough members to meet a quorum. New CRC members must be approved by the city council, but Delgado says it's been difficult to get those approvals on the agenda. When pressed by Delgado at the January meeting, Deputy City Attorney Heidi Brown suggested going to the city council to pass a change to city code, which would allow members to stay on the committee longer. This also comes as the CRC's parent body, the Independent Police Review, or IPR, which investigates complaints against police, is actively dissolving. Their director, Ross Caldwell, exited January 16th with no replacement on the horizon. IPR's staff finds itself in the position of knowing that their jobs will be ending within a few years, but not exactly when, which has led to some recent labor strife. The timeline for the CBPA taking over from IPR and CRC is partly dependent on the new board getting background checks, being trained, and hiring a director. But it also depends on police misconduct cases. Any officer-involved shooting in this interim time between the boards likely increases the timeline of IPR's work by at least 18 months, Delgado says. Before his election to City Council for District 2, City Councilor Samir Kanal was the project manager for the Police Accountability Commission, which spent 2 years crafting the basic form and functions of the new police oversight system. Kanal told KBOO some councilors are aware of the problems Portland's police oversight system is facing, but solutions haven't come before council yet.
The challenges are even bigger than just waiting until the new board is ready to go. There has to be an overlap while the new system ramps up and the old system finishes its cases in progress. The blockers can be things like policy around how long a person can serve, term limits, the need for council action to extend people even within the existing terms. And I think that these are things that are solvable. It just takes a certain level of commitment. I'm very happy to be the sponsor of something like that in council if there needs to be a code change.
The uncertainty of IPR and CRC's ability to effectively meet the need for a police accountability process comes at a time when increased protests are bringing Portlanders into direct confrontation with police regularly. Issues of excessive force haven't dried up either. As just one example, video surfaced in mid-January of a Portland police officer repeatedly punching someone in the head while pinning them on the ground at a protest at the South Waterfront ICE facility. But despite the uncertainty of how Portland police will be held accountable in this interim time, Kanal says it is still worth going through the existing system.
There's civil lawsuits, there's criminal charges, and there's administrative accountability, which is really the employment-related response. That's really what we're talking about here. And for that, I would suggest that people go to Independent Police Review. And I think that it's an imperfect system, and so is the new one. There, nothing is perfect. The new one will be better, but that doesn't mean that the old one is not worth attempting and going through to try and seek remedy for what you think is and have experienced.
The new Community Board for Police Accountability says it will hold its inaugural meeting in early February, though the date and details have not yet been announced. Their first order of business? Hiring a director. For KBOO News, I'm Sam Bowman, and additional reporting for this story was done by Jasmine Moss.
Two city councilors want Mayor Keith Wilson to fine the landlord of the Portland U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Building because of the organization's use of chemical munitions on protesters. Analita Murillo and Mitch Green wrote in a letter, quote, "Portlanders are demanding that we take action to protect our communities from our authoritarian federal government. We must act urgently with every tool we have," end quote. Last fall, Murillo and Green introduced a new fee for private property owners whose building is leased for use as a detention facility. That policy also included civil penalties for, quote, "releasing chemical residue beyond the detention facility premises into the streets or neighboring properties." The policy was adopted by the council in December and went into effect on January 2nd. But enforcement has not started yet, as the rules for doing so have not yet been finalized. The counselors say that recent actions by federal officers in Portland demand a swifter response. In their letter, they point to reports of chemical munitions being used by federal law enforcement against protesters last weekend. They also said, quote, "We recognize that it takes time to establish administrative rules. However, we believe there are concrete, immediate steps that you can take today to show Portlanders that we will not tolerate the tear gassing of our neighborhoods in violation of our local law," end quote. The city has banned Portland police officers from using tear gas on protesters since 2020, but federal officers have no such restrictions.
Meanwhile, the letter also asks Wilson to expedite another investigation already underway regarding the ICE property, a potential land use violation. ICE leased the building from a private landlord, but is under a land use agreement with the city. That agreement prohibits the federal tenants from holding detainees longer than 12 hours or overnight. In September, Portland claimed the ICE broke this rule at least 25 times in the past year and issued a land use violation against the property owner, Stuart Lindquist. If the city finds Lindquist has violated the land use agreement, he faces a monthly fine of nearly $950. If ICE doesn't change its detention practices, the permitting department can hold a public hearing to consider revoking that agreement. But it's not clear exactly what that would mean for the future of the ICE facility. Lindquist's lawyers have challenged the violation, claiming that ICE data do not support the allegation. ICE itself has not responded to a request for comment. Local protesters have specifically called on the city leaders to revoke the land use agreement. City councilors have publicly expressed frustration with this demand, as they say they have no authority over the decision. Wilson, who said any move to unilaterally revoke the land use agreement would surely land in city court. He added, quote, "We cannot allow hasty action to prevent us from taking meaningful action," end quote. Wilson previously called on ICE to halt all operations in Portland until an investigation into a January 8th shooting by U.S. Border Patrol in East Portland was completed.
As the Oregon legislature's short session rapidly approaches, Democratic lawmakers in Salem want to ask voters if the state can hold back some of that money. The kicker is the state rebate that kicks money back to Oregon taxpayers when state revenues exceed expected budgets. State Senator Floyd Prezansky of Eugene plans to introduce a bill this year that would permit the state of Oregon to keep some of that tax refund that would typically be returned to Oregon taxpayers when the kicker is triggered. The proposal requires that voters approve an amendment to the state constitution. If voters approve the changes, the first $300 million of future kicker refunds, would be returned to taxpayers. Any money over and above the $300 million threshold would get split evenly, half to taxpayers and half to the state of Oregon, who would target the overage to fighting and preventing wildfires, along with a boost to education budgets. A separate kicker law tied to businesses tax, are called the corporate kicker, sends money to schools when triggered. That proposed legislation would not affect the corporate kicker. Last year, Governor Tina Kotek was supportive of spending $1 billion of the kicker rebate for wildfires. However, a two-thirds vote by state lawmakers would have been difficult to achieve. Prezansky told OPB recently he wasn't sure what kind of support his bill would generate, but he wanted to begin the discussion. That discussion is something Senate Republicans may not want to be or really be interested in spending in the upcoming short session talking about.
The Oregon Nurses Association received a cease and desist letter from Legacy Health Systems after the Nurses Union publicly voiced concern about ICE agents' behavior at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital in North Portland. Peter Straczynski with ONA said, quote, "Unfortunately, ICE was not following the proper protocols that other law enforcement follow when they're in the hospital." He went on to say, it doesn't matter if they're in custody. It doesn't matter what their immigration status is. Everybody has those same rights, end quote. Starzynski said agents entered in plain clothes without identification, went into restricted areas with private health information, refused to leave patients' rooms, and rushed the care of detainees against medical advice. In a letter last month, the Nurses Association asked Legacy to intervene. Legacy also wrote that the Nurses Association claims may discourage patients from seeking care. Starzynski responded, quote, the bigger concern with scaring people away, having plainclothes, unidentified ICE officers wandering the hospital in places they aren't supposed to be, end quote. He said Nurses Association has already composed a written agreement that would update hospital policy to address concerns specific to the Department of Homeland Security and will set a date to meet with Legacy.
State and local governments consider whether to cooperate with immigration enforcement as criticism intensifies in Congress. Minnesota educators say the raids are frightening families, while the White House says it wants to de-escalate and change the subject. With that story and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This state has always been in the side of law enforcement, such as banning sanctuary city policies. This time we're asking our law enforcement to assist the federal law enforcement agencies.
Republican Indiana State Senator Liz Brown is defending a bill moving through the legislature to expand cooperation with ICE and letting the governor withhold funding from local governments that don't comply. Democrats warn the measure could strain overcrowded county jails and raise constitutional concerns. Maine's Democratic governor says the state will, quote, not be intimidated by an increase in immigration enforcement there, which she calls an attack on democracy. But in places like Springdale, Arkansas, local police departments are weighing cooperation with ICE raids. Jesse Bogan is a reporter with the Marshall Project.
The question is how are local police balancing local law enforcement in this community that has a lot of immigrants because they want to maintain trust?
President Donald Trump says he is de-escalating the situation in Minneapolis and wants a, quote, honest investigation into what happened when ICE killed two protesters there. The White House has reshuffled leadership on the ground in the city as bipartisan criticism of Homeland Secretary Kristi Noem intensifies in Congress ahead of probably contentious oversight hearings. A preliminary Department of Homeland Security review sent to Congress says two federal agents fired their weapons during the shooting of Alex Preddy Saturday, contradicting previous administration statements. The review does not say Preddy brandished a gun. After the two protesters were killed, Noem and others initially called the victims domestic terrorists. Boise State Public Affairs Professor Sam Martin says that framing risks undermining lawful dissent. He says there is little threat of actual criminal prosecution for public comments. But the broader pressure on protected speech will have an impact.
It's not primarily that speech is going to be prosecuted as a sort of criminal matter, something that people are not allowed to say and that they'll be punished for with fines or jail or whatever. The problem is expanding investigative pressure and stigma around people's First Amendment rights to engage in lawful political protest and lawful political activity.
In Minnesota, educators say fear tied to ICE near schools is disrupting attendance and frightening families. Columbia Heights School Board Chair Mary Granlund says schools are struggling to keep children safe and learning.
And we need your help to get our kids home, to get our families and communities whole again.
The White House says Trump is talking about the economy during a trip to Iowa, in part to change the subject. But farmers there say Trump's tariffs have raised costs and cut off export markets, especially for soybeans. New data show farm bankruptcies rising and manufacturing jobs falling as trade uncertainty continues. And in Virginia, a federal appeals court has struck down the state's new congressional map, ruling that lawmakers improperly used race-based districts to favor Democrats. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth for an in-studio conversation with Oregon Senate President Rob Wagner. At 6, listen in for The Underground. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's forecast calls for clouds and early morning showers with an overnight low of 38. Tomorrow, expect the rain to continue with an afternoon high of 52. Today in history, on January 28, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded 73 seconds after liftoff from Cape Canaveral. The quote of the day is from the first teacher in space, Krista McAuliffe, who said, quote, "I touch the future, I teach," end quote.
From an Inupiaq Wordle game to a new language immersion program, a wave of efforts to revitalize the Inupiaq language has been sweeping across northern Alaska. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. Language Workbook for Kids. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Elena Bengston has loved making art since she was a child. Now that she has a child of her own, she wants to use her art to help him learn the Inupiaq language. Bengston is an Utqiagvik artist who recently received the Rasmussen Award to create a workbook that will do just that. She will spend a year designing and illustrating a primer for children that teaches the Inupiaq alphabet and numbers. Bengston says her four-year-old son, Kahaliyauk, was her inspiration for the project.
It all kind of started with creating for him and being able to use those resources.
Bengston says she's still on her own language learning journey. She practices speaking with elders and uses dictionaries and the Rosetta Stone app. But Bengston says children learn differently than adults, and she wanted to create educational materials that cater to the youngest learners.
You start kindergarten, you have the whole workbook, you're learning the alphabet, the numbers, the colors, and we have all that in English, but I'm like, what if we had that in Inupiaq?
Bengston says some resources for learning Inupiaq are available through the North Sloboro School District, but she says regular parents might not have access to them.
It's really born out of necessity. I'm sure there are resources out there, but they're not something you can just go pick up at the store or buy online.
Bengston's project is just one example of the language revitalization efforts in the region. 2 years ago, the school district restarted its Inupiaq immersion program. And a few years before that, Alaska Native linguists created a digital Inupiaq dictionary. And when the popular puzzle game Wordle took off across the country, local linguists and enthusiasts created an Inupiaq version.
We've been making big strides recently. You know, with the history of it, it's definitely a dying language, but I think it's important we keep it alive.
Bengston says everyone can do their part to preserve the language, and the workbook is just one step for her. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
A former Navajo Nation poet laureate has been named by Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs as the state's second ever state poet. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Laura Tohi has dedicated her life to indigenous literature, but doesn't want that identity to dominate her tenure.
I don't want people to think that, you know, I'm just, again, shifting from Navajo Nation to Arizona as a Navajo poet.
And part of her pledge is to help bring poetry to rural communities. While most living on the Navajo Nation have no choice but to haul essentials like water, coal, and wood from far away, for Tohi growing up, it was books.
I did.
Born in Fort Defiance, Arizona, Tohi remembers taking long road trips with her mother to the closest library across state lines in New Mexico.
We did make it to Gallup, and I got a library card. She wanted to make sure I had access.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a hearing Wednesday in Washington, D.C., focusing on Native children. The hearing will examine the draft Native Children's Commission Implementation Act, which focuses on improving justice and safety outcomes for Native children. It includes tribal federal coordination on public safety, juvenile justice, and victim services. The hearing will be streamed on the committee's website. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As Minnesota Congressional Representative Ilhan Omar was speaking in Minneapolis Tuesday, Anthony J. Kaczmarczyk rose from his seat and squirted a syringe full of foul-smelling liquid into her face. Omar took a step back, then she charged after him with a raised fist. Kaczmarczyk was subdued by security. Omar returned to the podium and said, quote, "There's a reality that people like this ugly man don't understand. We are Minnesota strong, and we will stay resilient in the face of whatever they might throw at us. I don't let bullies win," end quote. She was attacked just as she called for ICE to be abolished and that Secretary of Homeland Security Noem, or Kristi Noem, should resign or face impeachment. Kaczmarczyk was charged with third-degree assault and is currently held in the local sheriff's office. Authorities have not yet identified the contents of the syringe used to assault Omar.
Officers of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension were turned away from the site of Alex Priddy's murder by agents of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, or DHS. Soon thereafter, U.S. District Judge Eric Tostrud issued an order barring federal agents from destroying or altering evidence related to the shooting, including evidence removed from the scene or taken into the federal government's exclusive custody. On Monday, lawyers for the Department of Justice filed a legal motion opposing Tostrud's order. Edith Olmstead of the New Republic wrote, "While it's not uncommon for the Trump administration to oppose judges' orders against it, this case seems particularly unnecessary and suspicious. As with Renee Good's murder, federal officials are preventing local Minnesota police from investigating and denying them access to evidence. A preliminary report from the Customs and Border Patrol, which includes evidence from the body cameras of the officers involved in Priddy's murder, that has not been made public, specifies the two officers who shot Priddy. In a DHS report released earlier today, an unknown number of Department of Homeland Security agents involved in Alex Priddy's murder were placed on leave as part of the department's protocol.
Republican legislators want to eliminate $890 million already approved for electric vehicle chargers. The charger money was originally included with bipartisan approval in the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, signed into law by former President Joe Biden. The funding, originally included in the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, was supposed to help improve EV range. Republicans in the U.S. Department of Transportation and Infrastructure Committee consider $2.3 billion of Biden's Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act as, quote, "wasteful Democrat priorities." That law included $5 billion in funding for states to boost U.S. charging infrastructure that is set to wind down in 2026. The law also included another $2.5 billion that was set aside for competitive grants that would allow states to build chargers in alternative fuel corridors and in underprivileged areas. Republican leaders say all the Biden-era moves to boosting plug-in cars amounted to an EV mandate that Trump promised to repeal on the first day of his second presidency. Once it was under Trump's control, the Federal Highway Administration in February 2025 suspended the program in one of several actions directed by President Donald Trump to eliminate federal support for wider adoption of EVs by consumers. A federal court in June 2025 blocked the suspension, ruling the Transportation Department's move overstepped its authority and attempted to override the will of Congress.
They're not just planting trees, they're building trust in the community. Volunteers in an underserved Milwaukee, Wisconsin neighborhood are all in on making their streets greener and shadier and building resilience. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Milwaukee, residents of Sherman Park are helping their area become greener and shadier as members of Wisconsin's first community tree board.
We are sort of the tree ambassadors, I say, for the neighborhoods.
Felice Green is a member of the volunteer board, and she works at the nonprofit Milwaukee Water Commons, which helped establish it. She says as the climate changes, Trees help protect communities by providing cooling shade and absorbing stormwater. But Sherman Park and other historically underserved communities have fewer trees than other areas. So planting more is important, and she says residents need a voice in that process.
We recognize the importance of everybody has an opinion, everybody has a say.
So the tree board talks to people about their priorities and concerns. For example, they invite residents to help choose which species get planted. They answer questions about how to manage fallen leaves. And before planting on a vacant lot, they ask nearby homeowners for permission. These conversations take time, but Green says they're worth it to get people on board and excited about growing and caring for trees in their community.
We want people to have a strong love relationship with trees.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael says he's no longer sure what America is.
You help someone who is being pushed and pepper sprayed by a Border Patrol agent, you get shoved to the ground face first, have your legal weapon taken, and get shot several times, some kind of orgiastic frenzy. This can't be America. Disagree openly and you could be shot, gassed, and or arrested. Five-year-olds can be arrested even if they're not protesting. The object of ICE is to freeze us with fear, keep us in our homes, quiet, mesmerized by screens spouting lies and hate. The Border Control drawing arbitrary lines it's unsafe to cross. If the bullies who executed Renee Good and Alex Pretty are not prosecuted, this will no longer be America. Donnie will change the name to his, like a shotgun wedding with automatic weapons. I'm getting allergic to the flag of the once United States of the formerly known as America. Reportedly, Alex Pretty's last words were, "Are you all right?" "No, Alex, we aren't." For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 28th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast